Live from Big Kahuna Burger, this is Austin Danger Podcast, now and forever, the only randomly curated Austin Powers podcast on the internet. I'm Kevin, as always, I'm joined by Soup. Nope, there it goes. There it is, it's flying around. Nope, there it is, goes all the way around. Around the bend. Producer extraordinaire Mackenzie Wilkes.
Hello.
Kenzo, it's a big week. No pressure.
The pressure is real. The pressure is on, I feel.
The feedback on the Cable Guy episode, you know.
I'm here to, you know, destroy dreams. I'm here to shatter ideas. That's what I'm here to do.
Time makes fools of us all, no? And nowhere is that more evident than in certain scenes from tonight's film, a legendary film, and I'll spoil my opinion, a marvelous film, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, but we'll get to that much later on in the episode. But first, Kenzo, you talk. I really do have nothing. I have nothing really that can get us in. Folks, I am fighting the last remnants of a really annoying and stubborn head cold. And I can't feel my brain, and I missed lunch, and I'm just having a rough, like, I'm having like a Mr. Magoo tier day. Like, some days you'll have these Mr. Magoo where, like, sure, nice things will happen in life, right? Things that your therapist will hear about and be like, don't accentuate the negatives. But everything you try to do goes wrong, and that's my day. So I want to hear about super producer extraordinaire Mackenzie Wilkes, and I want to hear about what you've been watching.
Yeah, I mean, I did some prep. I did some Pulp Fiction prep because, you know, I know we've talked, I talked about it a little bit last week, and we'll get more into our histories with Quentin in truly like maybe less than 30 minutes. But I'd seen a lot of his films before. We'll get into it more later, but, I hadn't seen a lot of his early work. I hadn't seen Reservoir Dogs, so I do have a story about that. And I hadn't seen Jackie Brown, which I've always been told by many people I would love. So I decided to just sit down and pop these two movies on. And so I figured it's what a better episode than to just say it here and now. So I'll start with Reservoir Dogs because it was the one I was a bit more cold on, I guess. I say cold, like, I like Quentin movies. I have a basic like of pretty much all of them, and there's just certain ones I love. And gosh, again, it's so hard not to jump the gun there, but we'll get into it a little bit more later. But I was in a staged reading of Reservoir Dogs many, many years ago in college. It was an all-female staged reading at a midnight showing at a fringe festival. So, like, super grungy, super fun. It was kind of just an experiment in, like, hyper-masculine words with women. You know, it was just kind of an excuse to do something fun. We had water guns filled with fake blood we were shooting each other with. It was great. I was Nice Guy Eddie, for anyone who's wondering. There's sure. a photo of me somewhere on the earth dressed up as Nice Guy Eddie. I will try to find it. Had a big gold chain. It was great. And because I was in that, I didn't want to watch the movie, I guess, because, like, I didn't want to be just doing an impression of a person. And so I was just going based on how the script described him, and I just didn't really want to watch it at that time, and then just never kind of got around to it. So it's actually on the Criterion Channel right now, which is wild. And obviously, as I was watching it, I remembered the major beats of the story. But I also was a little tipsy during my performance due to I was in the scene with Mr. Blonde, and we drank real whiskey in it, unbeknownst to me. And so I ended up being kind of tipsy by the end of that. So I didn't remember, like, the whole section with the reveal of Mr. Orange. So I was like, whoa, this feels new. But it was interesting. I mean, it's a great debut, right? Like, it's one of those, like, there were so many incredible debuts that came out in the 90s. And this is just an example of an incredibly smart and well done and well cast and well executed debut. Like, what a strong showing from a filmmaker who's coming out and saying exactly who he is with such a succinct film. You know, I gave it 3 stars. To me, 3 stars is good. There's just, it's hard with auteurs for me not to compare their movies to each other. Like, I feel that way about all my Pedro movies or about all my Lynch movies. Like, when it's someone who I watch a lot of, it's hard for me to see Reservoir Dogs and not know how much I love Kill Bill and be like, that's a 5-star movie to me. So where does this rank in regards to it? So I think it's really strong. I think it's really great. I think the, for me, the flashbacks don't do much for me, especially the Mr. Orange section. To me, it stunted the momentum of, I was just like ready to keep going into that big ending. And ultimately the Mr. Orange section just kind of felt like a filler to me, which I'm sure there's plenty of people who love that section, and Tim Roth is so great in it. But to me, I didn't like need the backstory. I kind of think that because he's not really digging into the characters in the too deep of a way, right? Like these characters don't have a lot of depth to them. They're kind of just like guys on a job. We barely know their names. I think that is what makes it good. So trying to infuse like a backstory to them, to me, I felt like I didn't need. Like the energy I need is in the room with the guns, with the blood, with the guys in the warehouse. Like if it was like a single setting movie of just these guys in a warehouse, like I'd love it. But I think it gets, for me, a little too messy with the flashbacks. But it also feels like a first-time filmmaker trying to compensate for that in the script. I don't know. I don't know if I'm seeing that wrong, but I liked it a lot. Not my favorite Quentin by far.
I'm saving my rebuttals for the Reservoir Dogs episode of Austin Danger Podcast, where we will relive all of this again.
But I think I did watch what could possibly be my favorite with Jackie Brown. I mean, God damn, I've been told for forever I would love this movie. And everyone who said that to me, you were correct. You were 100% correct. I absolutely adore Jackie Brown. I want to rewatch it immediately. And this is, it's a longie. It's a fucking longie. And yeah. I loved every second of it. I mean, Pam Grier is just magnificent in this movie. Obviously, Robert Forster is the kind of supporting performance everyone talks about a lot, and it's an incredible performance. To me, Sam Jackson, though, like, it's probably my favorite Samuel Jackson performance I've seen. Like, I think it might be my favorite.
We're already fucking dead. It's been 6 minutes.
No,
Reservoir Dogs is 3 stars as good. And Samuel Jackson's best performance is not in Pulp Fiction. Now, look,
he's,
I know,
great.
He's great in Jackie Brown, but
no,
my
yeah.
God, the level to which the show is already over is staggering. I'm so
no!
sorry. Staggering to me.
No, he's great in Pulp Fiction, but I just loved Odell. I mean, he's one of those actors. I was saying this as I was watching Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction to you in our DMs. I'm like, he is just one of the most charismatic, exciting actors ever. Like, he could be doing fucking anything on screen and I will eat it up. I think he is so brilliant in everything he's in. Yeah, and I think that his character in Jackie Brown is just so funny. Like, he's just having so much fun with that character. And I read an interview where he said it's one of his favorite characters he's ever played, and I think you can see that he's having a ton of fun with it. And him and Pam Grier play off each other so well. It's a blast. I wasn't expecting Michael Keaton to be in that. That was a fun kind of Keaton performance. Yeah, I don't know. I loved it. I think I wrote my review, the last hour of this movie is bound, and that's maybe why I love it so much, because it kind of turns into a sexy woman ropes in her would-be lover for a money heist, you know, stealing from a powerful man who she's connected to. Like thematically very, and like, and beat story beat-wise, very Bound-esque. And so, like, it was just so my kind of movie. Like, I absolutely loved it. I loved how... And it's the same thing I love about the best Pulp Fiction parts too. It's so character driven. It's like I could just watch these people talk forever, because it is so wonderfully character driven in a way that I think is when Quentin is at his best for me. And in all the movies I love from him, when it's like super character driven and just really interesting conversations and a great script, like, boom, that's all I need. And Jackie Brown is just like 2.5 hours of that for me. So I fucking love Jackie Brown. It might be my favorite. I'm going to revisit Kill Bill. I haven't watched it since college, but I doubt that love will go away for many reasons we'll get into, because that's a special movie for me. And it's how I discovered Quentin's work was Kill Bill. But really glad to have knocked both of those off my list, because I think the last two Quentins I'm not seeing now are Hateful Eight and Death Proof. Those are the only two I've never seen.
Oh, yeah, you're going to fucking hate Death Proof. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen parts of Death Proof.
I
remember when
it came out. I think you'll appreciate the second half of Hateful Eight, and you'll fucking hate. Guaranteed. Like, especially if you watch it as Grindhouse. Oh, my God. I think I quietly took that off the wheel, because it's just not...
Do you like Death Proof, and do you like
Planet
Terror? I fucking
love Grindhouse. Mm. Grindhouse was a seminal moment for me growing up.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to capture something that I desperately wanted to learn about, but just didn't have the resources at the time, being 14 years old, to like get into Grindhouse stuff. Now obviously, yeah. Kids today, for example, you can trip over something on Tubi and you'll fall into 200 hours of this stuff. But at the time, like, I didn't even know what to ask. So Grindhouse represented a pastiched version of all that stuff from like Bat and Spider territory, stuff we love now. They're not like good. Death Proof is Death Proof is pretty damn good. But like,
I know Kurt's in it. We love Kurt.
It's maybe his weakest movie because you have to subscribe to the rest of it.
I think I've seen parts of it on like TV. Like I know I've seen parts of it on maybe FX or like some sort of adult movie channel that would play, and I would see parts of it and I would be like, oh, this is Quentin and I love Kill Bill, and I would kind of see parts of it but never watched it. Weird thing about me though, I have seen Hobo with a Shotgun. Isn't that wild?
Oh, that's right. No, we've talked about this. All yeah, of because this stuff is, you know,
in college that movie blew my fucking mind. I've never watched it again, and I remember some random dude, I think Blake was his name. If Blake is your name, shout out.
Yeah, Blake.
He would wear bell
that
bottoms.
Really narrows it down. Yeah, a guy in college named Blake.
I think his name was Blake, and I feel so bad if I misremembered his name. I doubt he will ever listen to this podcast, but he used to wear flared pants that were the print of the rug in The Shining. That was the kind of guy he was. We were in a play called Suburbia, Eric Bogosian's Suburbia, together.
Ah, yes.
And yeah, I was the Martha Plimpton character, and she was in the original cast. And yes, Trainer, we're making up names at this point. Anyway, we were hanging out, and he was like, I want to show you this movie. And he also was the person who introduced me to Bikini Kill. This guy changed my life in many ways. And yeah, he showed me Hobo with a Shotgun. It fucking blew my mind. And I was amazed at how much I felt watching that film, and I'd be interested to revisit it. So that's actually my only really Grindhouse adjacent thing. But anyway, I'm getting off on a ramble. Reservoir Dogs is really good. Jackie Brown, I fucking loved. One day, probably soon, I will just go ahead and knock those last two Quentins off, so I will have seen everything by our boy QT. Yeah, that's kind of what I watched this week, really. I was just doing some prep for the show, because I just felt, I don't know, it felt like we were watching Pulp Fiction. It's totemic. It's probably like, I mean, Reservoir Dogs was obviously a sleeper hit, but I feel like Pulp Fiction was what like launched him into the stratosphere of culture. And so it just felt right to kind of check out what else was around this time for him. And so I kind of feel, it feels really interesting now that I can see the pieces that go from Reservoir Dogs to Pulp Fiction to Jackie Brown. Like it's kind of, right. I feel like I can have a more cohesive view of like how the films kind of exist together. So that was really fun. That was really fun. I'm trying to think. I don't think I really watched anything else. So other than Loot, I'm keeping up with Loot. Fucking love Loot.
There we go. Out of Loot.
Boom. Kev, did you watch anything this week?
Kinda. I was really sick and just not, I couldn't focus on anything. So like I put Dicks on in the background or something just to like fall back asleep. I watched the Doctor Who specials that have been airing over the last couple months. I'm getting back into Doctor Who. It's fine. These are fine. For those of you who are new to Doctor Who, you want to go on Disney Plus and you want to watch Doctor Who Special 4, it's called. Mm. Now, people will tell you you're going to want to watch all four of them. The first three are just for dedicated fans. They are not for you. Any of those people could explain what happens in those, and you won't have to have wasted 3 hours. I had a fine time with it, but Shutigawa is unbelievable as the Doctor. And I think on kind of his back, he's going to lead a lot of people back to the show, and maybe people will check it out. Mm. For those of you who don't know, Doctor Who is a legendary British TV series about a magic guy who flies around in a phone booth. And it's that again. It's pretty good. It's cutesy. It's earnest. And the guy running it right now was the guy who ran it when I got into it 19 years ago. So that's cool. I also watched the Conan O'Brien travelogue series, Conan O'Brien Must Go, which was awesome. That's another thing that really explains itself. It's a Max original. It's a travel series with Conan O'Brien. The guy we thought he was at his prime 20 years ago, but no, he somehow has continued to find other gears, further gears to just be funnier and better and more interesting. And between the podcast and this travel show, like my only complaint is that he didn't do more of them. There are only four and they're like 45 minutes apiece. And like, I know that like travel and like the show's expensive to do and complicated to do, but it's just so good. I want more. Trying to think of what else. A lot of sleep.
That's good.
I watched Hundreds of Beavers last night, which was great.
I saw that log come through. Yeah.
I think we should talk about that on the show at some other point because it makes end of year things very complicated for Kev is all I have to say.
Should I check it out? I can't tell. Like I saw like a single clip from it and I was like, I can't tell if I'd be into this or not. Like
so whatever you saw, that's the whole movie stylistically. So if that's going to get in the way, that's a liability and an issue. But if you saw The People's Joker and you like Looney Tunes, it's similar to People's Joker in that there's heavy use of like compositing and amateur green screen. And on Apple TV, like it kind of looks fuzzy and bad, but on purpose, because they're trying to make it look old timey anyway, on top of all the compositing. But what's been able to have been done? It's almost silent. It's an almost silent black and white comedy about hunting beavers in the new American West. And let me tell you, like, you know, Looney Tunes, the property is in a lot of trouble, but the spirit of Looney Tunes is alive and well in this film. These guys really get it. And it's just, it really hit me. And like, it reminded me of what humor does and how universal humor really is in its best forms. So if you like Looney Tunes, you'll love this. It's basically a 2 hour long Looney Tunes short. Maybe it's not 2 hours. It's like a buck, maybe an hour and a half, but doesn't overstay its welcome, which if you've seen a trailer is, you know, is an achievement.
Hell yeah.
But that's pretty much it. You know, I've been lying low. I'm watching one Ripley every 6 weeks because that show is about that fast. I love the show, but it's like, I don't want to watch two. I never feel good watching two. You know what I mean? Like I want to take an hour, live in it, and then leave it because it's deliberate and very slow. Unfortunately, that's all I got. And I have to say, I'm going to three shows this week. So movies, am I going to see this tennis thing? Not super likely. Maybe.
We might be going. Rachel is super interested in seeing it, so we might go on Sunday.
Reviews have been good.
Reviews have been very good. Like, I mean, there's like a couple outliers, but people are going cuckoo bananas for this movie. Seems very fun. The score is like deeply my shit. It's like kind of like, I don't know, like techno-y house music, which is,
yeah,
I love.
Yeah, it's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, right?
Yeah, so, there yeah. You go. Give me that score, please.
But that's it. I really haven't been watching much because I'm tired.
Well, speaking of being tired.
Whoop-dee news. What does it all mean, Basil?
Yes, it's time for Austin News. This is the segment where we go through the news and notes in the world of Austin Powers. The Shagadelic News, baby, of which I have, I will say, I was looking for Austin News and AOL regurgitated articles about the Dr. Evil Super Bowl ad from 2 years ago.
What?
The way it pulls up in Google News is like, this just in from Daily Beast, Dr. Evil Super Bowl ad.
Okay. That's so silly.
Yeah, it's pretty weak. I mean, but this is AOL, right? This is all they do. They don't care. You'll click on it.
Well, I have a kind of less news, but more just Austin online chat that was making me think of our show this week, if you'd like me to share.
Yeah, let's go for it.
So this is, again, not less news and more just like something that happened on the internet this last week. But on April 18th, Twitter account named @MovieDisciple posted the opening sequence from Austin Powers, where famously Austin is the Hard Day's Night reference. You know, he's walking through the streets. We get the, you know, we get the song. He's walking around. A lot of great references. Went viral. I saw this thing 100 times. Original tweet just says the opening scene of Austin Powers is fucking incredible. And I was seeing just constant quote tweets of people saying how genius they think it is. Many people pointing out the Hard Day's Night references, people pointing out some blow up references that happened in the opening credits, as well as other 60s films. People were praising costume designer Dina Apple for putting together such an incredible just set piece of incredible costumes on a limited budget. People talking about how much they love the moment when he comes around the corner with the marching band. Lesson in how to, this is indeed a masterclass in how to open your movie. Still so powerful. Mike Myers really had Austin Powers and Shrek in his hands back to back. Just really genuinely like a ton of just Austin love all over my timeline of people just revisiting this and being like, fuck, is this a great movie? And the answer is, people, yes, it is. Austin Powers 1, I think, holds up well and is an awesome fucking movie. And that is one of the greatest openings ever. So yeah, it was just really fun to see, like, truly every time I was scrolling, I was seeing people just talking about how much they love the opening. So it once again is another piece of our little weird theory about how, or I guess a piece of the puzzle to our question of our podcast, which is, why is Austin Powers still relevant? Like, there's this original tweet got like 16K, 17K likes and almost 4,000 quote tweets. Like, people were talking about this for days. And I just think it's so interesting that Austin still has a place on the internet. And a lot of people love him.
There you go. Did anything cause this, or was somebody just like, look at this?
It was just a person said the opening scene rocks. And then it blew up on Twitter, as sometimes wants to do. A lot of people, there were some people talking about specifically the guy you might know. He's in the green corduroy pants with the striped shirt. And there's like a part where Mike is center screen and this guy's right next to him. And he is going so hard dancing wise. A lot of people were commenting on that dancer specifically, but yeah, it seemed to just be that. And then some other people were also sharing the Britney Spears sequence from Goldmember. So like, people were just kind of like talking about how much they love Austin's openings, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah, again, it's random. Nothing caused this. There was not like an anniversary or Austin news to prompt it. People just sometimes post Austin Powers clips, because this isn't the first time I've seen this on Twitter randomly, where someone just tweets about Austin Powers and suddenly it's my whole day.
Well, there you go, Mike J. Roach, food for thought.
Food for thought.
What else is going on in Austin Danger podcast news? I'm on Escape Hatch this week talking about Speed Racer. That went up last night on their main feed. They will be returning guests. Actually, who joined us? It was Escape Hatch. It was JH and Jason, who will be coming back. And then Catcher from the Cinenauts podcast,
mm-hmm.
and often Dune Pod contributor, who needs to spin the wheel on our show. So we need to figure out a way to make that happen.
Absolutely.
That's long overdue. And we also have to start, we have to get back to collecting the Canadians.
Yes, we do.
We have to collect the Canadians and we have to complete our collection of Cinenauts. And I think we may do one of two things this year. But mm-hmm. anyway, enough of that. Kenzo, it is time to talk about Pulp Fiction. Regular listeners of the show may know that we kind of just leapt right in here because there's going to be a long night. So why don't you start at the ending, where it begins.
Yes.
And bring us through to the beginning, and then to the middle in between the beginning, and then back to the end, and then we'll get started.
A couple sits in a diner debating their recent scores of robberies before deciding to rob the diner they are in, then and there. Elsewhere, and before, two hitmen, Jules and Vincent, arrive at an apartment to retrieve a briefcase for their boss, Marcellus Wallace, killing those who double-crossed Marcellus in the process. Once they deliver the briefcase, Vincent purchases some heroin and gets high, before taking Marcellus's wife, Mia, out to dinner while Marcellus goes out of town. After dinner, Mia accidentally snorts some of Vincent's leftover heroin and overdoses, so Vincent races to his dealer's house where they revive her with an adrenaline shot. Vincent takes Mia home, and they both agree to never speak about the events of the night ever again. Later, Butch, a boxer who Marcellus paid to take a dive in his upcoming match, double-crosses Marcellus by not only winning the match, but killing his opponent. Now on the run, his girlfriend Fabienne preps their escape from town, but when Butch is getting dressed, he realizes that she forgot to pack his beloved watch that was his father's. He returns home to get it, intercepting an assassination attempt from Vincent, and kills Vincent with his own gun. Escaping his apartment scot-free, he runs into Marcellus, who attacks him, but not before Butch runs him over with a car. The two injured men attempt to shoot each other, and Butch runs into a pawn shop for safety. Unfortunately for the men, the shop is run by a serial rapist named Maynard, who knocks them out and calls his friend Zed, also a rapist. In the basement of the pawn shop, they trot out their gimp, who they have hostage in a cage, and rape Marcellus. Butch is able to escape, and while he could abandon his enemy, he chooses to go back and save Marcellus from his rapists. The two men agree that they are even, and Butch leaves L.A. Back at the apartment from the beginning of the film, we then see that after we originally cut away, a person leapt out of the bathroom and attempted to kill Vince and Jules, missing every bullet before Jules and Vince killed them. Jules believes this survival to be due to divine intervention, but more on that later. They take away one of the guys from the scene, and Vincent accidentally shoots him in the head on a bumpy road. They take the body and the car to one of Jules' friends named Jimmy's house, who calls a cleaner to help them deal with the problem before Jimmy's wife Bonnie comes home. They dispose of the car, the body, and their clothes before going to grab breakfast. The diner they go to is the same one that the young couple decides to rob. Jules is able to overpower the robbers with his sheer charisma and allows them to take his money in exchange for keeping his wallet. He monologues about his favorite Bible passage, the divine intervention he experienced earlier, and his decision to leave this life of crime behind because of it. The robbers take the cash they have and leave. Jules and Vincent leave the diner with the briefcase. And that has been another issue of this Pulp Fiction. Did it. Boom.
Is that all?
There's a lot going on and it's all in the wrong order. So I was like, how do I do this?
So Kenzo,
yes.
Let's resume where we left off in your history of Quentin Tarantino as discussed. Regular listeners of our show, we've all heard the Reservoir Dogs story. What else is going on with you and Quentin Tarantino? Because, like, outside of that, Pulp Fiction's a first watch.
Pulp Fiction is a first watch. I genuinely don't know why I never came to it. It very well could have just been the reputation of the film. I feel like it's a poster you see in every dorm room, right? It's like that poster of Mia on the bed is burned into my brain. I mean, that is a symbol of culture to me in the 90s. The mid-90s is this era of a new indie cinema. Like, that is the poster child for it, quite literally. And so maybe I was just intimidated by it. I'm not really sure. The first time I ever encountered Quentin Tarantino was Kill Bill. And I don't recall why or how I watched it. Somehow I did. And that movie was like genuinely like life-changing to me. Like watching Kill Bill when I was like 15, 16. No, I think I was 14. I was pretty young the timeline of the different houses I lived in growing up. I think I was actually 13, 14 when I saw that movie. Probably 14 because I was homeschooled and I had moved out from where I normally had lived. So I was really isolated from a lot of my friends. Like, I was a really lonely child at this point in my life in early high school. And I found this movie and I had never in my life seen a film where a woman was that cool. Like, Beatrix Kiddo was immediately like the coolest character I've ever seen in my life. Fell totally in love with Uma Thurman and watched a bazillion bad movies for her during that time in my life. But like, Beatrix Kiddo became like this very special character to me. I loved that movie. I watched it over and over and over again. I begged my mother to buy me on eBay a pair of the Onitsuka Tiger yellow and black shoes that she wears with the jumpsuit in
that's
part one.
Wild.
I looked goofy as fuck. Like, they made my feet look small, and I they were bright yellow, which goes with zero outfits when you're 14 and self-conscious.
You have to commit to a full bright yellow jumpsuit.
Yeah, it looked good with no clothes, and I was like, it was so bad. I bought these shoes. I barely wore them. The bottoms were also so thin that if I tried to wear them outside, like, you'd feel every rock. They were very bad shoes. But I was obsessed with this movie. And by the time I was about 16, 17, my mom had gotten me these massive fucking posters, volume one and volume two, the biggest. They filled up half of my wall, literally. And I had them flanking my TV in my teenage bedroom. So it was like Kill Bill, my TV, Kill Bill. Like, I was obsessed with Kill Bill. And I haven't watched it since college, and I'm over fucking due. I am literally going to watch it this weekend. I just remember loving these movies. They changed my life and I loved them. And they opened my mind to like genre filmmaking, kind of like heavy genre pastiche, because I started getting really into things like Phantom of the Paradise was a big thing for me in high school. Shock Treatment, the sequel to Rocky Horror. Like, I started getting into really kind of like genre heavy things, and it's all because of that. So I find it interesting that I never watched Pulp Fiction because I loved Uma Thurman and I loved Kill Bill, directed by Quentin Tarantino. Never went back to Pulp Fiction. Around the end of high school, Django Unchained came out, and that was the first movie that was coming out when I was into Quentin Tarantino, quote unquote. I had seen like two movies technically. And my grandmother and I used to go to the drive-in movies all the time, and that was the last movie we saw together actually before she passed away. That's the last movie I can remember seeing with my grandmother. I have the best memory ever of my grandmother like opening the door and like having to get on the ground. She's laughing so hard at the KKK eye hole mask scene. So it's like genuinely a wonderful memory I have of watching Django Unchained. And then like that was pretty much it for Tarantino. I think I told you I randomly watched Four Rooms maybe because I think Madonna's in it. And I was like, I need to watch this from, I was also huge into Madonna in high school. I don't know. So I've seen Four Rooms, remember nothing about it. And then only kind of as an adult on Letterboxd, so like within the last couple of years, I watched Inglourious Basterds and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Hollywood was coinciding with the 70mm episode, I think. I'm colder on it than most people because I don't love the like real life stuff. Like I love the stuff with Pitt and DiCaprio, and I don't super love the Manson family Sharon Tate stuff. So I wish that it was just kind of about these two guys dealing with their washed up careers and the feelings of what legacy am I leaving behind. I kind of wish it was all that. Whenever it is that, I love that movie. And Inglourious Basterds is, I mean, so great. A masterclass, I think, in like building tension in scenes. I mean, the opening scene alone is, I think, one of his best opening scenes that I've seen. Yeah, so like I am generally very warm on Tarantino. And again, you know, I watched Jackie Brown and Reservoir Dogs this week. I like both of them. I've yet to find a Quentin that I just actively dislike. Like, I almost always enjoy what he's doing. I almost always enjoy what he's riffing on. And while I find his, ironically, in regards to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, his obsession with legacy and this 10 movie bullshit, I find it to be a little exhausting. What evens it out is he made some movies I fucking love. And I love that he does things like buying out the New Bev, saving a cinema and creating this incredible place for film in LA. Like he does stuff like that that I love. So cutie, he's a complicated guy, but I generally really like his movies.
You know what I think might be most interesting about that whole story, and there's a lot of really beautiful stories in there. What I think is most interesting is, so in contrast, I grew up, I fell in love with the Wes Anderson movies, and that opened my film bro brain. Mm. I was getting into Tarantino around 05, 06. So my first Tarantino was Grindhouse, a movie, again, you'd hate, in my opinion, just a vibe. The vibe is like not it. I think you may like Death Proof isolated, but the vibe is... I would be very curious.
I mean, I used to have a big old crush on Rose McGowan because of Charmed. And so I was very interested.
That'll probably do it.
In that other one. And I remember being like, and never actually pulling the trigger. But I've seen many photos of her with the gun leg.
Grindhouse is a fun ride. I'm not convinced that Planet Terror is any good. But Death Proof is pretty great. I mean, it's fun. It's a zombie shitty thing. Like, I don't know. You know? But it's also a 90-minute... Look, I saw that movie, incredible... Changed my life, etc. I got my learner's permit to see Inglourious Basterds on opening night. In fact, it came in the mail that afternoon, and I was like, fucking, ugh. Because that was the first night where I was like, okay, one for Inglourious Basterds, and I showed my ID, and there it was.
Ooh.
Inglourious Basterds came out August 21st, so my birthday was actually, like, earlier in that week. So it was like... by a hair, I got in.
Ooh.
And, you know, I've had a mad love affair with all his stuff since then. So it's interesting to see, like, you're coming in, and I'm a big nerd, so I know all the references and shit. So it's interesting that we're having such opposed ideas of Tarantino. Mm. You coming at it, like, experiencing all this stuff at face value, and then film bro Kev, you know, oh, well, obviously this is a reference to this, and that is that, or this is inspired by this, or... whatever, because those are the two modes you can enjoy him in. And there's a generational, I'm not saying there's a generational divide between us, but generally there's a generational divide. What are the reactions of like the kids? Are they even bothering with movies like Tarantino, you know, like new film fans who haven't seen his stuff? What do they think? Who are coming into this like we were at 14 and 15 getting into this stuff for the first time. What are they thinking of this stuff?
That's so interesting. I don't know if any Gen Zers listen to this show, but yeah, like I think I'm like, think of that whole era. Like, I don't know why I'm thinking of Boogie Nights also as kind of another kind of secondary, you know, after your debut film that has a huge splash that might make some kids clutch their pearls nowadays. Like, I'm curious if there are like young film fans, like 14-year-olds now born in 2010. That makes me want to throw up everywhere.
Are they watching
Pulp Fiction? That is, I am curious. Because, I mean, I'm coming to it almost 30. I just avoided it because it's so totemic. You know what I mean? It's like, I feel like it's, again, that poster just lives in your mind because you see it everywhere. If you are interested in film, like you will be aware of Pulp Fiction pretty quickly.
Kenzo, can I get us the hell out of this part and just rip the Band-Aid off and ask you what you thought of the movie in the most general terms?
Yeah.
Okay. In the most general terms, Mackenzie, what did you think of the movie?
I feel complicated about it. I'm not going to lie.
Interesting.
I'm not going to lie. I was vibing profoundly with this movie for a very long time. I loved the opening section, right? I feel like this type of dialogue between Jules and Vincent Tarantino's kind of been known for this almost humor that is drawn from kind of extraordinary people or strange people having very ordinary conversations. And that's kind of what I feel like a lot of his dialogue is known for. And so I think that the dynamic between Vincent and Jules is so great. Again, Sam Jackson is so effortlessly charismatic and funny. And I think that Travolta is playing it much smaller than people anticipate him to, and so he's doing a lot of really interesting work here, and we'll talk probably a bit more about his performance.
I wonder if people are anticipating... We'll talk about it.
But that dynamic is great. I mean, the whole opening sequence is amazing. It's filled with all the memes, right? The memes you've seen a million times. English motherfucker, do you speak it? Does he look like a bitch? All these great, amazing lines that are just as good as you want them to be in context. All the times you've maybe seen them as a gif. They're even better in the movie. And I was like, oh, this fucking rocks. And the section I have seen the most clips from is then the next section with Vincent and Mia. And so I think I just assumed that was a larger part of the film, because all the clips I see, I feel like Uma is the face of the movie while she is only really in one section. You know, she's quite literally the poster girl for the film. And I feel like her monologue about silences, be down in two shakes of a lamb's tail, like, her dancing, the feet, the coke, I said goddamn, like all of these clips I have seen dozens of times, and that is what I associated most with Pulp Fiction. So seeing it in context, I was having an awesome time. I was like, this fucking rocks. Uma Thurman is doing some incredible work. I think she's just one of the most interesting actresses. I love her in Kill Bill, obviously. I love her in many things, and I adored her here. Like, there was like a part where it looked like Mia was about to cry, but they never even talk about it. And she kind of just pushes it down. Like, you're watching Uma play this profound loneliness so subtly and so interestingly. It's great. The tempo of the whole overdose into the resurrection. It's brilliant. I was having an amazing time that's a large portion of the movie, like a little over an hour. And then like we get into the Bruce scene, and obviously like I don't love the gimp and rape section. I find it deeply gratuitous and unneeded. But
put that on the back of the box. Right? No kidding.
I don't know.
Does
who,
anybody?
Like, yeah, I don't know who is going to this movie like, fuck yeah, that scene. Like, it's uncomfortable to watch. I'm fine with discomfort as long as it feels like there's a purpose to it. And it just didn't really feel like there was a purpose to it to me in this movie. But even outside of that, the Bruce section I just wasn't very interested in. Like, the watch monologue was long. I get the joke, but I don't particularly find like man sticks things up ass to be a funny joke personally for me. And then the Bruce section, just like him and his girlfriend talk, like I just kind of was like, I don't care about him. Like, I want
you don't care about the blueberry
about
pancake.
Fabi and the blueberry pancakes.
I used to hate her. I've come
blueberry
around.
Pancakes. I mean, she's fine. Like, I just think that whole section just felt like I was sitting there being like, why am I here? Like, the characters that I find most interesting are gone, and Bruce is cool. Like, I loved the scene with the cab lady. Like, that was so sexy and fun, and I thought that was gonna be more of a thing. And then he goes to the boring French girlfriend, and you're like, okay, bring back the hot Colombian taxi driver. Come on.
I mean, there's something to be said about the path of the righteous man,
right? I guess
I'm not really in the mood to formulate this, but there's talk about honor and an honorable path.
Yes.
And in the most extreme possible case they could think of, which is just like gags about the movie Deliverance. Mm. Awesome. Killing it, QT. Awesome choice. Hilarious. Butch goes back, right? He does the honorable thing, and
sure,
he is freed and he lives, versus characters like Vincent, for example, who took the divine intervention. Okay. Because this is all divine, and that's how it ties together. Okay. Now, I don't think anything justifies the rape, or the gimp, for example. And, you know, there's all sorts of questions about what am I supposed to feel when I'm watching this? Mm-hmm. How am I supposed to react? Is this supposed to be funny or
that's
shocking?
I couldn't tell. Yeah. I didn't like it.
It's unfit, but there is something to be said about divine intervention and the way that the characters interact with it. There is a reason why there's theories about the suitcase containing Marcellus Wallace's soul, but I think that's not. I don't know about that theory, but the point I'm making is that I think that the reason that whole story is there, one is because it's a pastiche of pulp novels, so they wanted to do a boxer not following the mobster's advice and running away story. But it also ties in thematically to, like, there is a righteous path and there is a way out, and you could either follow that or get shot on the toilet and then fall into the bathtub in perhaps the most hilarious death pose I've ever seen in my life. I think that's what we're getting at here with the Butch story, but I agree with you that, like, the movie's 2.5 hours long and everything around it is one of the great movies of all time.
Yeah, and
so what are we doing?
So much of Butch's story just felt so tangential to it to me, and like do I need to see Vince die? I don't know. Like, I kind of just, like, cared about what I was seeing, and then when this happened, it felt like I just slammed into a wall. Speaking of Looney Tunes, like, I felt like I was just, like, pff, like, flattened against a wall when this section hit, because it just kept going. It felt like it was just going forever, and then you get to that awful ending, and you're like, oh, God, I didn't need to see any of those. Like, what is the purpose? And then we get back, right? Then we pull back, and then I haven't decided yet how I feel about the non-linear storytelling. I think it's interesting, but I'm not sure if it, like, completely worked for me. Not in, like, a movie-ruining way, but I'm just not sure it totally worked for me, because then, yeah, we're back here, and the whole divine intervention thing, I feel like, came a little out of nowhere for me in the way he kept harping on it.
Yeah, no, it does.
It
let's,
doesn't really.
Let's call this out
the,
fully.
The thread there
it
just
comes
doesn't...
through at the end of the Butch. The Butch story ends, and then we're back in the classic "Does he look like a bitch?" scene from Act One,
mm-hmm.
and we see the second half of that scene finally, where we see Phil LaMarr's amazing Marvin come into the film. And this dude comes out and shoots at Jules and Vincent and misses both shots. And they are, like, clear bullet holes right behind the guys.
Mm-hmm.
And this changes Jules' life. He's like, I have been given a path, divine intervention. My life is saved. This is my opportunity. I will take the path of the righteous man and go. Which is a lot to introduce all at the end. Especially, I mean, even if your movie is out of order.
Yeah, I guess so the Bruce scene kind of got me down, and then I'm like, okay, we're back with the characters I like. And then, like, the whole cleaner section, while I loved Harvey Keitel, we'll get into it, but, like,
Jesus, we're getting into it right now.
But, like,
this is into it.
Throughout that whole section, because I had already gotten, like, I also just felt like, why am I seeing this? Like, why? Like, we already saw them in their clothes and the package was dropped off, and we got to, like, we already moved past this. I know there's someone screaming at me right now listening to this podcast, but I wasn't as, like, I mean, one, it's the cringiest fucking shit on the planet from Quentin Tarantino himself with this character, just dropping the N-word a little bit too casually for my fucking taste. And then, like, and then it's just, like, this long sequence where I love Harvey Keitel. I love him saying, it's 30 minutes away, I'll be there in 10. And then the cut to, like, it's been 9 minutes and 20 seconds or something. Like, that was so fucking funny. Loved Keitel's character, but the whole sequence, it just felt like, again, like, it reminded me of those flashbacks that didn't work for me in Reservoir Dogs, where I was like, I feel like you're just filling time, dude. Like, what are we doing here? I don't know. It just, that sequence didn't work for me, though I fucking loved Keitel. I thought he was so funny in the sequence.
I wonder why. Was it just to get them in the wardrobe change to tip off the fact that the entire Butch sequence happens after this? But then it's like, well, why are we doing that? That is, you know what? That is, I hear that. I really love the movie for all of these things.
For sure.
But yeah, I could see the trying to discover why it's out of order like that. Besides the pulp pastiche.
Yeah.
Like, besides the idea of, like, I'm reading through, but if you're reading a pulp magazine, then wouldn't they be all different stories? What's the difference? Why is it, instead of it being A, like, four short stories that are distinct, this is A, D, C, B. Like, this is, you're giving me one long story in chunks because no one's done it like that before, and it seems cool in 1994, which is not at all. I've heard worse motives. Cha-Cha Real Smooth is way worse of a motive than that.
I mean, I don't want it to be want anyone to think I'm not a fan of like non-linear storytelling. I think there's plenty of films where it works totally fine for me and blows my mind. And when it's well done, it's really interesting. But like, I think it does need to have a purpose. And I think sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I just don't know if the non-linear worked for me here once I had already been like kind of pissed off by the end of the Bruce sequence. And then now we're going back to stuff I feel like I've mentally moved on past. And I'm like, why am I seeing this now? Like, maybe even if Bruce wasn't there, going back there wouldn't be as egregious to me, but the film stunts so much for me in that middle portion. I don't know. And then, yeah, by the time we get to the diner, I've lost a lot of steam. And I just felt like that whole sequence with, while I love Sam Jackson, I wasn't following the thread on that kind of character arc. And that whole last sequence felt so fucking never ending to me. And so like, it was weird. I started so high. And then by the end of the film, I just lost a lot of steam and was beginning to question if these choices were really genuinely working for me. And the Bruce section did a lot of heavy lifting for why it fell in so much.
I'm happy we walked through your experience because I know I realized we were chatting last night watching yeah. the movie. No, this is exactly, you know what? This is exactly what I wanted. So I'm happy that we did this
okay.
up front.
Okay. I'm worried that's like, too much, but yeah.
No, this is exactly what it is. Cause then we'll get into the, you know, for folks who don't know, we were chatting last night, Kenzo fired up the movie and I was like, well, I'm not going to fit it into any other time. So I threw it on myself, which was awesome. A great experience. But as the scene started coming up, I'm like, that's going to come up on the show and that's going to come up on the show. And then that, like the meaning of that became more and more negative as we proceeded into the movie. I'm like, ooh, blueberry pancakes coming up on the show. You know, Zed's dead's coming up on the show.
Well, Kev, yeah, so this was definitely, again, I have to assume there are many listeners who are just like ripping their hair out. And for that, I do apologize. But this, I'm a first time watcher coming to this. And this was kind of, you really got a full sense of like my arc as a human being during the course of this film. But Kev, you've known this film way longer than me. What is it you love about this watching experience? Because like you've not hidden that you're a five bang for Pulp Fiction. So I want to know like why the nonlinear storytelling works for you. Why maybe that middle section works for you. You kind of explained it a little bit, but I'm curious what works. I want some positivity.
There's an angle of this where if you were there at the time, it was really fucking cool. Or if you were a kid or whatever, and it was all new to you, that stuff's really fucking cool. I love the way Christopher Walken says ass up his ass. I think that is funnier than you're giving it credit for, but not by much.
It's just not my taste of humor. I think a lot of people love that scene. From what I could tell, I'm in the minority. Totally fine.
I like his performance of that speech, but I get what you're saying. And again, it does lead to the whole... kind of questioned the Butch sequence. Now, listen, I think the rest of it is great enough that you can kind of whatever with it. But like... I didn't think this time. This time I looked at it a little closer and was like, that's not funny. But to answer your core question, I mean, you're in love with the dialogue. You're in love with the characters. You're in love with the idea of the righteous path. I love the way that Jules tries to figure out, but by misquoting this biblical verse here, like he's trying to figure out his own thing and he doesn't even know what that is. Like his notion of what happened to him is askew. It's not quite right. Mm. So like even in his goodness, he is bad. I love the characters and the way the movie is shot and edited. The writing, the conversation up front that is a suite. It is a three-piece suite of Royale with cheese, the pilot, the foot massage talk. Does he look like a bitch? Immediately. It's just masterful.
Absolutely.
I agree with you that for me, the wheels start to fall off around the Butch storyline. Although the Butch storyline has good stuff in it. I just don't, besides the obvious utility of he has to kill Vincent, I don't understand why he's even in it. Besides the Marcellus Wallace of it all, but we don't know Marcellus Wallace. That we never really get to know him that well. We know him humiliated and as a victim, really.
Yeah.
A man who has been humbled, and maybe something will come of that. And maybe not seeing what would become of that is the point. I don't know. So, it, I mean, it's a vibe. It's a movie I've always loved, like forever. It's, yeah. I don't know, but I can't defend the stuff that doesn't work, the stuff that is bad, like Quentin Tarantino allowing himself to say the N-word. Although, do you ever see the clip where Sam Jackson was asked about that? I think it was on the Django press tour.
No, I haven't.
And his response was awesome. So usually it's like well-meaning, progressive enough white people asking him this. So his answer is, what word is that? And it's like, he's like, say it. And they obviously won't say it. And that is not a bad answer to that, I guess. Coming from Samuel Jackson. Coming from Kev, maybe a bit of a harder sell. But yeah, I don't know. I'm struggling to describe it. It's all about the vibe. Like, Kenzo, we can go through. I'm wondering if we could do something that we don't usually do on the show. I'm wondering if we could do a blend of real discussion and popcorn.
Yeah.
And I want to hear some positives from your first watch. And maybe that'll help to kind of spell out what I'm talking about. Not to immediately pass the buck back to you.
No. I mean, like, I'm thinking of like the positives. And again, I think for me, and I think probably a lot of people who are maybe just fine, this movie feel the same, but like the Vincent Vega and Marcellus Wallace's wife, that was the movie that I want. Like, I don't know what about that scene. I mean, a big part of it was probably Uma's performance. I love her. I've loved her for so long. Obviously she was major for me in Kill Bill. And I mean, me and Ian were actually texting today. I would buy movies at like Goodwill if anyone I liked was in them, and anyone I liked meant Uma Thurman, Meryl Streep, and Anne Hathaway. And oh, wow. I watched so many, like, I watched My Super Ex-Girlfriend a bunch. I watched Prime.
Oh, God.
From, like, 2005.
When are we doing The Avengers? Did you watch The Avengers?
I did not watch The Avengers, no.
Ooh, fake Uma Thurman fan.
I know. Well, I was spotted. Like, it was just whatever, like, Gattaca. Like, whatever was at Ross's Dress for Less.
Yeah,
or,
Gattaca's great.
Or Goodwill is what I watched. But I loved her so much. And, like, I still do. I feel like she kind of hasn't done a ton the last couple years. I did see she's going to be in the new Schrader movie, though. So maybe Uma's coming back, which, please. She's incredibly talented. So, like, Mia was such a hypnotizing and intoxicating character. Like, I would have taken a whole film of just her and Vincent hanging out. And so I love what Uma's doing. I think she's just, like, a fucking, like, she is a shot of adrenaline to my heart when I'm watching this movie. Like, she fucking comes in and she kills it for the whole time she's there. And I love it. So that's part of why I loved it. Travolta is doing such cool work in this section. I love him playing like high, but still like functioning kind of like it was, I was so charmed by it. It's like a performance I've never seen from Travolta. And it kind of blew me away in this section. And him and Uma's chemistry on screen and the rapport they had was so fun. Like and the twist, I mean, obviously the twist is iconic and it's fucking awesome. And like, them sharing the milkshake and like it's so good. Like I would have just loved it if this movie was just the two of them for 2.5 hours. Like, I don't know, I loved that section so much. I loved the immersiveness of the diner. That diner's fucking amazing. Like, I want to go there immediately. Like, it was so immersive. Like, you get to be so
Jackrabbit Slims, man.
Yeah,
medieval. Talk about, so this is our second in an ongoing Austin Danger podcast series of great themed restaurants. Yes. One real, one not real, although they did convince you.
Yeah, I was like, can I go here? Like, I was like, is this in LA when I go next month?
I'm surprised no one's built one or tried to build
literally
one.
Quentin,
like the unironic Pulp Fiction one that kind of sucks.
Yeah,
because that's what it would be, is like, you know,
I need Quentin to build it himself. He's owning a bunch of businesses in LA. Make a Jackrabbit Slims. I wish I could go here. It was so them getting into the car, oh, to sit in a fucking car table, like I was just living. I was like,
yeah, did I tell you we had a classic Hollywood Burger King back in my neighborhood back home?
What the fuck?
And it was like themed after, it was not Hollywood specifically, it was like TV.
Yeah,
so the booths, in between the booths, like you would sit, your back would be to the booth, and then there would be a divider, and the divider was a 50s TV show, it like with a little image of like Howdy Doody and stuff on it.
Whoa.
And in the middle, in the back, in like the middle of the room, there were cars, fake cars, and you could sit in them. They were not quite comfortable, but they were like the hot real estate. You wanted to sit in the car.
Fuck yeah.
At the Stony Brook Burger King. RIP, by the way. They remodeled, so no more. But it was there.
for a long time. I love that. Well, I wanted to sit in that car. I thought it was amazing. So like, yeah, I loved the script and the vibes of the first section with Jules and Vince. Absolutely loved the second section with Mia. And then, yeah, I don't know. Like, the Bruce section took so much wind out of my sails because I just didn't enjoy really any of it. Like, I mean, other than, like, I thought the taxi thing was kind of interesting. I loved the pastiche of the car, the fake background in the very still car. Very, very, yeah. Like, 50s, 40s. Thought that was, like, a fun pastiche. A little out of place, but I still enjoyed it. But, like, after that, he gets out of the car and goes into his hotel room. Like, it was just, like, Snore City for me, and then I just hated the ending. And then yeah, like, maybe it made me realize like Mia was a big part of what I liked, because then by the time we're back with Jules and Vincent, I was just kind of like, yeah. So yeah, I guess you said bring some positivity. The positivity I have is that second section is, I think, totally brilliant and incredible, and like my favorite performances in the film happened during that section. And like, I mean, God, you see that stabbing sequence, that is such a like clearly like Stars Born but like filmmaker, like that is such a fucking iconic moment that like it's kind of cool to see like the birth of something so iconic in that sequence. So like, yeah, for me that's where a lot of the positivity lies, is I and that's where a lot of my popcorn is, because I just fucking love that whole section, and after that it just kind of fell off cliff for me a little bit.
Yeah, did you love Buscemi as Buddy Holly?
Yes, that was fun to see so him funny. There. Yeah, Alexis Arquette plays the dude that jumps out and shoots. She plays, obviously pre-transition, she's playing this person who fails to shoot Jules and Vincent. But she gonna return in a movie I love, The Wedding Singer. She's great in that, and I hope surely that connects. It's like so in our pocket, in our wheelhouse. So
it's on the wheel.
So yeah, love Alexis Arquette. That was another random, but yeah, I love the little cameos. Steve was great. Buscemi, love him. Did you see the last random thing I wrote, and then I want to hear your like big thoughts and popcorn. Did you read that? I think it's, you know, Quentin, I feel like, is known for kind of connecting his worlds randomly. Did you see that Vincent is supposed to be the brother of Mr. Blonde? Did you read that?
Yeah, yeah. He wrote a movie, supposedly, and yeah, they were supposed to do it right after this. Thank God they didn't, because I find that stuff all, like, you know, candy, apple, cigarettes, whatever. But, like, outside of that stuff, Big Kahuna Burger shows up later in other Tarantino films. Like, that stuff's cute, but outside of that, I just have no interest. So yeah, when you hear news like the film critic, which was going to be his last film that he's rescheduled, yes, or whatever, he's not doing it anymore, that was supposed to be another universe thing with Cliff Booth yeah, from Hollywood. Bleh, vomit for 10 years. I'm really happy we dodged that bullet, because that shit is boring to me.
Yeah,
I don't want to really explore these characters anymore. I feel like it's done.
Once Upon a Time almost feels like it's 10th film, you know, in terms of a film about legacy and what you're leaving behind. And I feel like he just doesn't know where to go.
The ending is perfect. The ending is perfect. Oh, if she had lived.
Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, I mean, for Pulp Fiction, right? It's a totemic movie. I looked at it closer here than I ever had really before.
Because
I knew that there were things, right? Like, Zed's not. Now, Zed's already dead, right? You know
yes,
this. But Zed was not going to survive this. That's a star gone off of Kenzo's score already, I could tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, gone. So I wasn't going to defend Zed.
No, I wasn't expecting you to. No.
I told you about the Burger King TV. The five. Okay, so first of all, I've given up soda. I'm very proud of this, even though sometimes it turns me into a wild animal, apparently. And when I saw Vincent order the Vanilla Coke, I was like, my man, this guy gets it. Vanilla Coke, the greatest drink in the history of the world. And then Uma orders a $5 shake, which, like, today is nothing.
Yeah, that's a normal $5
shake.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Yes.
I love that. I love the twist. The shots, there are these, a lot of times when there's action, the movie is pretty carefully, the camera's pretty careful, but then there are these really great handheld moves that follow the characters. So my favorite one is from behind. Eric Stoltz, who did not play Marty McFly in the end, if you recall, plays the drug dealer character in the robe and the speed racer tee.
Yes.
And the camera follows him out, like from his kitchen out into the front lawn. and out seeing Vincent carrying Mia into the house. That shot is unfucking believable. The cameraman is on it. Everything is perfectly aligned, but he's jerking it in such a, he's moving the camera in such a way that you could tell it's handheld. Trainer, don't do anything with that. Don't do anything with that. I loved it. I mostly vibed, I have to say, yeah, with the exception of our notes where I basically cringed in anticipation of. I love Phil Lamar, you know. Phil Lamar has great, one of the hardest jobs in the whole movie. First of all, legendary voice actor.
Yes.
Love the guy. He has to sit in frame as Jules gives the entire speech to Brett at the beginning of this film.
Yes.
And he has to sit there and he has to make you believe that he is gonna, he thinks he's dead. You know what I mean? Like, yes. Minutes go by. This full coverage, I would kill to watch the full shot, the full take of just Sam Jackson and Phil Lamar, just to see what he does when the camera cuts away. Like, what was he doing back there? Because that stage, you know what I mean? It brings back to this great Conan moment. There was an actor who was asked, what's the difference between stage and film? And he was like, here's film. He stood up and it's like, here's film. Do a close up on just like shoulder up my, you know, do a medium shot of me. This is film. And then he said, okay, now show the whole thing. And he had, his pants were down. He was like, that's theater. Cause that's theater, right? That's acting fully. You're fully exposed.
Yes.
You're in the space with everybody. They can all see you, whether they're supposed to see you or not. It's the beauty of it. One of the many beauties of it. So it felt very theatrical to see Phil Lamar in the back of frame like a prop, terrified. And then it turned out he had nothing to be afraid of with Jules because it's fucking idiot Vincent who probably wouldn't have killed him anyway. I thought that was great. The overdose scene, Mia, the willingness to show the disgustingness of the overdose and how gross and terrible it is and how no one feels good afterward and it totally kills the mood of the whole thing. And some would argue tonally the whole movie for certain people, maybe, like, cause that's the end, right? That's when the fun stops. I think it speaks to Tarantino maybe wanting to show that it's not all vanilla Coke and $5 shakes and twists with Buddy Holly. And like, there's actually real things that go on and violent consequences. Might've been his motive with Mr. Orange, but I'm not being smug about it. I don't know. I haven't really done that deep of a dive on Reservoir Dogs, but like, it does speak to a greater horror, a greater reality, a greater underneath. Almost kind of, almost faux Lynchian.
Ooh.
Right? Like if you think this was gross, there's a whole other world that is just as worse. And this world they're living in is also vile. So I don't know. Could there be something there? I think that the vagueness around it is frustrating, but also fascinating and really helps the enjoyment of the film. Is like, could he have meant this and not this modern day YouTube explainer version, but like actually engaging with the piece. Although again, with the vagueness, did they intend for you to engage? It's enough to drive you crazy. Bruce looking right down John Travolta's eyes and then John Travolta looking the goofiest possible when they meet again and he kills him. I couldn't believe how silly. Like, how do you shoot that? How do you be on the set that day and be like, okay, this,
I don't know.
Like, that's the sound he looks like. But I loved it. I thought that was great. We talked about the handheld. Another great handheld shot is Bruce. This one is actually the best. It's the one where we see Butch get out of his car. And he's walking through the lot to the apartment. And it's the one long shot through the big vacant lot.
Yes.
Absolutely ruled. That does rule. I loved that shit. Loved that shit. And I think also, you know, we covered a lot here.
Yes.
I feel good about this discussion. If we missed something, austinnagerpodcast@gmail.com is always an option.
Mm-hmm.
It was an option last week when we pulled it on the wheel. But Kenzo, I don't know, man. I'm dying to hear this. I got to know what you think of this film.
Yeah, I don't think you or many people are going to be happy with this. I've been talking through it all day. I've been figuring it out all day. And I've ranked it and where I think it stands amongst the other Tarantinos I've seen for me. seen for myself. And yeah, I mean, you're right. The whole Bruce thing, like, it took it from a possibly 4.5 to a 4 at the very least. And then I just, like,
oh, okay,
didn't get it back, and it kept falling for me. I think it is, for me, better than Reservoir Dogs. I think it is, which I gave 3 stars. I think it is a step up in, like, production and vision and performances. And I think it's really great for how iconic and influential the film is and how much it blew people's minds in that time. But much like I said in my Reservoir Dogs review, he would go on to make films I love way more than this. And I just don't think, for me, this film works as much as those other films do. So for that, it is 3.5 for me.
Yeah, I mean, I get it.
I know I'm in the minority. People love this movie, but, like, I like other Tarantinos way more than this. And so much of it just didn't work for me personally.
But the thing also is that I find that people have also kind of forgotten about the things that happen in this movie. People talk about the wolf, not a lot about the Quentin Tarantino character who says those things, right? Mm. I was showing this movie to somebody 10 years ago, and I forgot about the Gimp altogether.
Mm.
And then when they go into the antique store, I'm like, fuck. Oh, no. I should have picked any other movie. Although they ultimately enjoyed it and it didn't mean anything. But, like, shit. Like,
if all I was remembering was the Mia Vincent section, yeah, I'd find this to be a perfect movie. But I unfortunately see the rest of it that I didn't like as much. So
I get it. And it hurt it in a way that I just haven't had it hit like that before.
Mm.
It did not change anything for me with the rest of the movie and what it means and the whole larger thing, because I was there, Gandalf. Well, I wasn't there, but I was there enough.
Yeah.
And I saw it early on, and it's a very influential movie in a lot of ways. And my brain feels like scrambled eggs. So 5 stars for Pulp Fiction for me. But yeah, so I get it, but still am able to love it. I understand, but it's a bit of a problematic fave. I do love the Christopher Walken speech. That absolutely totally hits.
I want you to Bruce love stuff. It. We can disagree, and it's totally fine.
No, I get it. We do disagree, but I agree with you that there's stuff in it that is... I enjoy watching the Bruce stuff, although in an English class sort of way, I can understand structurally that it draws stuff into question.
Mm-hmm.
Although, thematically, you could tie it in, but the vagueness of the themes of the film don't really help the argument there. Nevertheless, I enjoy that stuff, and I love the French girlfriend now more than ever. I used to really hate her, and I'm just all about it now. I could not possibly tell you what has changed.
I love this.
Except for my brain body, my brain chemistry. So, Kenzo, with that, I would like to do our little show. May we?
Let's do our freaking little show.
I Love Gold. Ooh, weird. This is I Love Gold. This is the segment where we go over what awards the movie of the week won. What won these awards? Pulp Fiction, you ask? So, look, this was actually a pretty huge movie year, 1994.
Mm.
There were two pretty massive movies to start. Maybe you've heard of them. Forrest Gump and The Shawshank Redemption.
Gump.
Forrest Gump, of course, if you remember. Remember how your parents loved to smoke weed in 1965 and then hated everyone in 1988 by voting for George H.W. Bush after voting for Reagan twice. The fascists, right?
Never seen it in full. I've seen
Forrest
clips.
Gump is a balm for hippies who gave up their values in the 70s.
Whoa.
And if that seems harsh, why don't we do Forrest Gump one day? We will, because Ron Howard, Clint Howard's in it. So
I've never seen it in full.
No, it's a Zemeckis, but there's links all over the place. There's links up the old wazoo.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was Ron Howard. That's how boring I find Forrest Gump conceptually. And Shawshank Redemption. We love Guti, who loves this film.
Never seen it.
But I've never seen it.
So. Yo, we got to get Guti on if we ever do it for our first watches. Fuck yeah.
We will be doing it. I'm saving it, officially saving it for the show. So, but it may not surprise you to learn that despite Forrest Gump's many wins for these fucking people that still ruin our politics today, Pulp Fiction was nominated for 7 Academy Awards.
Hell yeah.
And won one. So it was nominated in Best Picture, John Travolta for Best Actor, and Sam Jackson for Best Supporting Actor, Uma Thurman for Best Supporting Actress, Quentin Tarantino for Best Director, Sally Menke for film editing, and QT and Roger Avery, the hosts of, oh God, the Video Vintage. They host a podcast now, but they won the best screenwriting.
Oh, hell yeah.
This movie cleaned up at critics associations all across the country. You know, I like to call out the ones we're from. So, of course, Chicago.
Yeah.
Chicago, of course, nominated for Best Picture Actor. You know, Travolta, Jackson, Thurman, all nominated Best Picture. Quentin won Best Director in Chicago and won Best Screenplay as well with Roger Avery. So, hell yeah, that's awesome. I wonder, okay, Tom Hanks won Best Actor. And I wonder if Best Picture also went to Forrest Gump, or is it? No, it was Hoop Dreams. Wow.
Yo.
Well, that's the power of Siskel and Ebert.
Yes.
That's the sway that Siskel and Ebert had. Holy moly. That is fascinating. At the New York Film Critics Circle Awards, same deal. So no Travolta in actor, but Jackson and Thurman. Jackson nominated for Best Actor, straight up, so upgrade. And of course, nominated for Best Film. Tarantino and Avery won for Best Screenplay, and Tarantino won for Best Director. Finally, at the MTV Movie Awards, this movie won Best Movie. Uma Thurman, John Travolta, Sam Jackson. Okay, so Uma Thurman and John Travolta were nominated for their performances, and Jackson and Travolta were nominated for Best Duo. Mm-hmm. Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon was nominated for Best Movie Song. We'll talk about that in a moment. And Best Dance Sequence, the winner. But of course, was the twist competition between Uma and John. Vibes immaculate.
Yes, vibes immense.
Finally, at the 1995 Clatrudis Awards.
Yes.
No wins. Sam Jackson nominated twice, both in lead and supporting. Bruce Willis nominated for Best Supporting.
Yo.
And of course, Uma and the movie. So I'm looking right now at the 1995 Clatrudis Awards. And I think I'm taking the time in here because it's worth it. Oh my God, Best Actor was a tie between Morgan Freeman in The Shawshank Redemption and, this is a massive twist, Wallace Shawn for Vanya on 42nd Street.
Yo!
How sick is that?
That's sick as fuck.
The best movie was The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, although Vanya was nominated.
They're making an unneeded sequel to that movie, just announced.
Yeah, they already made an unneeded musical, so they're willing to do whatever it takes to milk it. Whatever.
Ooh.
They'll do it. Next, it's time for the Alan Parsons Project. This is a segment where we tie our movie of the week to the Austin Powers trilogy. One of the bigger links here is Neil Diamond. Oh boy, we love, what do you think, Mackenzie? Do we love Neil Diamond?
Sure, why not?
He sings the songs, right?
What's that movie with Jack Black where they're like weirdly obsessed with Neil Diamond? I feel like that played on Comedy Central all the time. God, Saving Silverman? Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's it.
Yep. So that's what I associate Neil Diamond with. I
thought about that movie.
Yeah,
years.
I just remember it playing on that and like Orange County, like playing on Comedy Central all the time and me randomly seeing parts of it.
Well, obviously, Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, one of the great needle drops in this film.
Yes.
But did you know that through our link to Neil Diamond, we will one day be covering films such as Fever Pitch with Jimmy Fallon, where we could talk about Jimmy Fallon once and for all.
We can get this over with.
We will be talking about Blood Simple by the Coen Brothers.
Great movie.
And I'll also call out Donnie Brasco, which is a really good, unfortunately, Johnny Depp is in it, but he's really good. And he plays against like one of the last times Al Pacino ever cared.
Mm.
So pretty good. In the best boy department, returning from our Armageddon episode, Rob Lubell. One day we'll do Stuart Little. And it's because of Rob. A Mighty Wind also was him.
Whoa.
I'll also call out the actor known just as Zane, which I believe we have discussed this person before. I'm trying to look for the movie. Willard. Yes, Zane returns from the Crispin Glover remake of Willard.
What?
He's a post-production accountant at New Line Cinema. Or he was at New Line working on Austin Powers and Willard. But I guess he was at Miramax beforehand because he's also credited on Four Rooms and the movie Deep Cover.
Ooh, he worked on The Long Kiss Goodnight, which is a film that I find very fun.
Yeah, that'll be great. The Astronaut, Pleasantville. Pleasantville, an essential Kev movie.
Whoa.
On cable constantly when I was a kid. I have not returned to it. Even thinking about what that movie could mean kind of fucks me up.
Wow.
So thanks, Zane. Also, finally in the sound department, David Abrahamson, who will give us Red Notice. God bless. Red Notice. We got to get Sophie back to do Red Notice. And Slim. We got to rope them in. When? There you are. You're over there.
We have no use over there, and the tape is running so long. So if you would like to send us a letter or a voicemail about Pulp Fiction, about anything we've ever watched or what we're watching next week, austindangerpodcast@gmail.com. We're over 100 episodes in. Y'all know the drill. We will share it on the show. Let's fucking go.
Yeah, and if you're ever wondering, like, why didn't they talk about this? Why didn't they talk about that? It's because, like, we don't live in your head. We're too busy people. We're just humans. As the Flaming Lips once sung. So make sure you have your voice heard. Send in the stuff you love and want us to talk about to austindangerpodcast@gmail.com.
And Kev, the people can tell us anything they like, especially about the films we cover. Kev, it's time to spin the wheel.
Yeah, a little mystery, nerve-wracking. I'm hoping for a movie that's under 2 hours. That would be really nice.
We get a five-hour film.
My prayers have been answered.
Ooh.
So Tarantino recently in the news, there was a little bit of synergy there. Planet of the Apes in the news recently, a little bit of synergy there. Our next film is not the first film we've covered by this director, who is coming out with a new film this year.
Shit.
We are returning to one of my favorite filmmakers, a guy who, even when he misses, he's fascinating. We are...
Who is
returning
this?
To his home city, but not in the way we left it last time. A city where he sets all of his films. This is one of the more divisive movies that has come out in my eyes. I found it so interesting when it came out. It was like bandied around as proof that this guy was washed. But really, if you watch it, there's so much interesting stuff going on here. Yes, it is the 20th anniversary of M. Night Shyamalan's The Village, and next week on Austin Danger Podcast, we'll be going back. 18th century Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, baby. We're getting in that DeLorean, going right back home.
Wow. Yo, The Village, I know of the scary movie spoof because it played on Comedy Central a lot.
Yeah. Oh, first watch of The Village. I love The Wheel. The Wheel has given us, I think, a really good movie this time. I'm really happy about it. But damn, I wish we could just do the scary movies.
I watched the first one a couple years ago, but I haven't revisited any of them.
I personally, Kev, booked us into a corner this year, but man. Frustrating. All right. Well, no, it's not frustrating. Will it be frustrating? Will you love it? If you haven't seen it, now's the time. M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. We are doing it next week. I don't think it's streaming anywhere. Sorry, but it's very rarely streaming anywhere anyway.
It is not.
But that's next week. For now, for Mackenzie, this is Kev. Austin Danger Podcast, peace.
If you want to find us on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Austin Danger Pod. This episode was mixed and edited by me, Mackenzie. Thanks for listening.